Welcome to Preaching and Preachers, a weekly podcast devoted to those who preach and to the task of preaching itself. I'm your host, Jared Bumpers, Assistant Professor of Preaching and Evangelism at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Today, I'm excited to welcome my colleague, Dr. Patrick Schreiner, into the studio. Patrick is the Associate Professor of New Testament and Biblical Theology here at Midwestern Seminary. He's written numerous books, including The Ascension, and most recently, it hasn't been published yet, getting ready to come out. We're going to talk about that. But the Transfiguration book that is an exegetical and theological analysis of the Transfiguration. And so that's what we'll spend the bulk of our time talking about today. But excited to have you in the studio. I know you also serve as a pastor at a church in the area, Emmaus Church. Right. So, man, welcome to Preaching and Preachers.
Great to be here. Good to be talking to you.
Awesome. Well, before we jump into talking about the Transfiguration, we'd love to hear you just give an update on life and ministry. Tell us about pastoral ministry at Emmaus. Tell us about your family. How are things going?
Yeah, love being at Emmaus. We are a church in North Kansas City, which is just a little north of the river. The city's on the south side of the river, so we're close to the city. They're actually talking about putting the new Kauffman, maybe, baseball park there, yeah. But probably won't work out. We're hoping they do.
Yeah,
love Emmaus. It's just a great church, biblical, confessional. We do liturgy every week, so we just love being there. Our kids love it. They were just at Ready Conference for Youth, and so that's great to be in town for this type of stuff. And then the kids are doing well. They're just in school, and we just keep trying to be faithful with where we are.
Yeah, praise the Lord. We're glad you're in Kansas City, glad you're serving here at the seminary, serving the local church, and it's always encouraging to have other guys, you know, at the seminary who've bought into the vision of the seminary existing for the church and invested in local church, and you do such a great job of teaching and writing and being involved in academics, you know, presenting at conferences at the same time. Yeah. Being connected to the local church and doing ministry there as well. So appreciate you being
I'll just add there that staying in the local church in terms of keeping on ministry in there, I think keeps you grounded. If you're in the academy, sometimes you can get to these questions that are like, oh, you think are so important. And then you go into the local church and you're interacting with people that aren't thinking about this all day. And you're like, you just know what's real and what is valuable for people. And it's good to ask academic questions, but you got to be able to bring it down to people so it can affect their life. And so I think it's just hugely important to stay involved in the local church.
Yeah, that's a good word, especially for those who are listening. And if you're a seminary student, you know, you're living on campus, you know, here or another institution, man, get the most out of your time, ask the academic questions, do your studies, but don't lose sight of the fact if God has called you to ministry, that he's called you to serve people, and you need to be able to be a regular person who can have conversations and address issues that the people are asking, not necessarily things that you're reading or talking about in the classroom.
Right. Get a hobby. That's what I always tell seminary students, like watch the Chiefs or do something like so you can talk about so you can talk about something else too. It's great talk about Bible and theology, but I think you need to be able to connect with people at different levels. So
Amen. That's a good word.
Especially about the Chiefs, right?
Yeah, that's right. Man, the Chiefs playoffs have turned it on. We'll see how things go. Super Bowl Sunday, but
that's right. We're recording before Super Bowl Sunday, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure this will be released post Super Bowl, so listeners, you'll know before we do. So, well, great. Well, I'm excited to talk about the Transfiguration, and you've written on this recently. The first question I wanted to ask is, you know, what drew your interest to the Transfiguration? I know you wrote your dissertation on the Gospel of Matthew, published on the Kingdom, written on Matthew as well, and so written on the Ascension.
Yeah.
And so, tell me how you kind of moved into this particular field and this topic.
Yeah, so it somewhat follows my Ascension book in that I think there's kind of major events in Christ's life, his birth, his death, his resurrection. Even if you go to our library or any theological library, there's going to be a ton of books on just those topics. I mean, I went to our library and there's multiple shelves on the resurrection, which is true and important and so good, right? Yep. We need to have those. But when I wrote my book on the Ascension, I was looking at maybe what we could call a more minor, I actually argue it's not minor, but what we would consider a more minor event in Christ's life. And I just wanted to put our eyes on that and say, man, this is really important. And so I'm actually following that in one sense with the Transfiguration because, again, you go to our school's library and I actually looked on the shelves. There was like, I think two or three books on the Transfiguration. I was just kind of surveying books as I was thinking about this topic, and he writes like famous Jesus in the Victory of God. What is it? 900 pages on Jesus's life. I think there's like one sentence or one comment about the Transfiguration in that whole book. And obviously like he's doing what he's doing in the book. That's not a critique, but I think it just is emblematic of how when you think of Jesus's life, I don't think the Transfiguration often gets mentioned. It's not usually talked about. And so it's following in the stream of kind of a series that I might do over time. One, the Ascension. Second, the Transfiguration. Then I'm thinking about doing something on the Descent of Christ, okay, which is just, again, an event we don't think a lot about. And I think all these events, I'm not saying they're as important as the birth, the death, and the resurrection, yeah, but that they shine different aspects on Christ's life. And we should be thinking about them. And for me, each of them have kind of brought the whole Bible together in a new way, not in a new way, like in a heretical way, yeah, but in a new way of like, oh, I see these themes and I see how it's so important. So it is following on kind of the more minor events in Christ's life and just putting your eyes back on them. It is, yeah, interestingly, in the history of the church, it's the Eastern Orthodox Church that spends a lot of time on the Transfiguration. And it's Protestants and Catholics who haven't spent as much time on it. So even for resources for me, I had to go to a lot of resources that I'm not used to reading in terms of Eastern Orthodox theology, just to kind of even have conversation partners for this.
Yeah. 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 That's great. And I think for those who are listening, you know, you're talking really about Christology and yeah, important events and saying, okay, you know, yes, some of these are major high points, but the other parts of Jesus' life and other events in Jesus' life also matter for us
as
Christians. And so,
that's right.
Yeah, I think it's helpful that you're shining a light on this particular
shining
topic.
A light.
I know.
You know, your little pun?
I
you
smiled a little bit. I did it on purpose. But shining a light
all right,
on
here we go.
Light, this topic.
Light bright.
So,
no.
Yeah, that's right. So, moving into the actual text here, you know, you have Matthew 17, Mark 9, Luke 9. I know you work through those are the big gospel texts. You also mentioned earlier, you and I conversing, Jesus, I'm the light of the world in John's gospel, and then Peter's reference in 2 Peter chapter 1. And so we'll see how far we can get into that. But
yeah,
I thought what I would—
Let's do the whole Bible.
Yeah, just do the whole thing, right?
Yeah, let's go.
Old Testament, you know, but you foreshadowing and types and then fulfillment. But I'd love to kind of walk through Matthew's passage.
Sure, yeah.
And just kind of read it, ask a couple questions.
Yeah, that's great.
And then if we have time, maybe jump over to Mark and Luke and say, okay— And even John and Peter, if we have time, and say, okay, what do these emphasize that is maybe not emphasized in Matthew?
Sure,
so
sure.
Matthew's
we're probably never going to get there,
never
but that's
there.
Okay. We're going to try it.
We'll make it as far as we can go. Good. All right, so Matthew 17 here, and I'm reading from the ESV. It says, "And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves." And so opens, you know, 6 days, any significance to that? High mountain significance there, inner circle, you know, sometimes there's conversations about, you know, James, John, Peter, Andrew, you know, not here. Other times he's mentioned, walk us through that first verse there.
Yeah, so you get a timestamp after 6 days. All of these details, I think, are hugely important. They're telling these stories. Matthew was not on the mountain with Jesus, but he's hearing about this story from others. You're going to get Mark, who tells this story, and then he's Peter's interpreter. So Peter's on the mountain. Yep. Interestingly, John doesn't tell the story, but I do think he has the themes. He's on the mountain with him.
Yeah.
So after 6 days, you do have to set it up in terms of context right before this. Interestingly, in all the synoptic gospels, it's the same context beforehand. Sometimes they move stories around a little bit in their gospels. But for the Transfiguration, it's like kind of sealed in terms of the narrative flow, which is nice in terms of the point of the narrative. And so the big thing that you have to realize is right before this, in all the gospels, Peter has confessed that Jesus is the Messiah. And so there's this like high, it's almost like a mountaintop scene. Like there's this high point of, okay, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, Peter. He realizes Jesus is the Messiah. He's not just another prophet. But then Jesus predicts his death. And Peter's like, no, 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 this is not how the messianic role is going to go. No, no, no. So Jesus rebukes him. So you kind of go down into this valley. And then Jesus talks about like, you're going to have to pick up your cross and follow me. And so you have this high moment. And then you kind of jump back down into the valley in terms of Jesus's death. They're confused. They're wondering what is going on here. And then Jesus, I think the main point of this narrative, actually, this is after 6 days. In 16:28, you have to back up one verse. Jesus says, "Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Mm. It's after he says 6 days after that he says that, which is the seventh day, right, that the Transfiguration happens. So I think what's happening is I'm the Messiah And then you go down the valley of, I'm going to die, and this is the hope. Even though I'm going to die, glory is going to come. And I'm going to show you a picture of that glory. I'm going to give you hope. I'm going to give you comfort. Even though death is coming, on the other side of that is glory, both for you and for me. And so that's after 6 days. It's after 6 days that he said this. Wait, some are standing here who won't taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Every single synoptic writer has that phrase right before the transfiguration. So I think it's actually fulfilled at that point.
Yeah, immediately, yeah.
But, okay, so we might be here for 4 hours, but I have multiple things to say about after 6 days. After 6 days also alludes to Moses. It's after 6 days that he goes up on Mount Sinai, right, and goes and sees Yahweh himself on the top of the mountain. And then after 6 days, it's Seventh-day theology. I think it's new creation theology.
Yeah.
So already just with the timestamp, you're thinking about the context of Matthew, and then I just think you blow it out to the context of the canon and then the context of eschatology. This is like new creation themes. And so already Matthew and Mark is after 6 days. Actually, Luke says after 8 days, but I think it still fits. It's just a different way of counting,
yep.
if that makes sense. Eighth day is kind of like new creation day. That's
yep.
another way of describing it. And so this whole narrative for me is just, you kind of have to double click on everything because there's so much going on. Do you want to pitch back? I have a lot more to say about a lot of the details in this verse,
yeah,
but
no,
yeah.
That's great. I do want to say, I was hoping you would go, I assumed you would go
yeah.
new creation. I anticipated that
yeah, yeah.
coming, just the
yeah, yeah.
biblical theology part coming out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, talk a little bit about and you can talk if you want to expand on the 6 days a little bit, but maybe talk about the significance of the location, mountaintop.
Yeah, yeah. So it says high mountain. I think it's Mark who also says high mountain. I think it's Luke. I could be getting these backwards, but it says a mountaintop, just a mountain. It doesn't say high mountain. In Peter, he calls it a holy mountain. So that's interesting, just the little details that we have, high mountain. Now, there's a lot of debate about like which mountain is this. So most scholars are like, oh, is this Mount Tabor? Because that's kind of the traditional site. Or is it Mount Hermon? I came to the conclusion that they don't tell us
yeah.
and that they don't tell us on purpose because it's a real physical location. But the point is that it's on a high mountain.
Yep.
And if you think of mountains in the scriptures, mountains are places of revelation. Mountains are places of connecting heaven and earth. Mountains are places of theophanies. Mountains are places of progress in the covenantal story. So I think Ezekiel tells us Adam and Eve were created on a mountain. I think you have the story of Abraham, Mount Moriah, when he's sacrificing, where he attempts to sacrifice Isaac
yeah.
in obedience to the Lord. Again, you have Mount Sinai. So a high mountain, it's this symbol for something big is about to happen. A revelation is about to happen. Maybe you're about to see God, which I actually think occurs here. And then he has with him Peter, James, and John. And when Moses goes up Mount Sinai, it's Nadab, Abihu, and Aaron who go up with him. And so you just have a lot of echoes to the Sinai story. You have the Psalms in terms of who shall ascend the mountain of the Lord, Psalm 24.
Yeah.
There's just – this is about to be a revelatory moment. And so all these details, who's with him – when it takes place, where it takes place, they're hugely important.
Yeah, and I'm hearing, you know, numerous connections. You talk about Exodus.
Yes.
You know, 6 days, Moses, 6 days.
Yeah.
The number of people that are with Moses, number of people that Jesus takes up on the mountain.
That's right.
Sinai, you
yep.
know, the location is a mountain.
That's
Sinai,
right.
Moses is mentioned explicitly. At Sinai, there's fire and smoke, a cloud descends here. I'm sure you're going to get there.
Yeah, it's all
like,
there.
It starts. Cumulatively, this case starts building.
Totally,
their intentional connections here.
Yeah, and this is both storytelling and historically what happened. And
yep.
so he's telling it a certain way on purpose. And this is what happened. It was after 6 days that Jesus did this happen. So yeah.
At Midwestern Seminary, we recognize and celebrate the many faithful pastors who dedicate their lives to serving local churches. To show our appreciation, we're giving away a $10,000 pastor appreciation package. Half of the prize can be used for a well-deserved family vacation, and the other half can go toward any need in your church. Plus, just for entering, you'll receive a free ebook from Charles Spurgeon. Be sure to follow us on social media for weekly giveaways and encouraging pastor appreciation stories. Enter your pastor to win at www.mbts.edu/pastors and join us in celebrating those who serve the church so faithfully. Lastly, if you're interested in applying to Midwestern Seminary and Spurgeon College, if you use the code PAM24, we will waive your application fee, and the first 60 applicants will receive Volume 1 from Charles Spurgeon's new Park Street Chapel sermon set. We hope you'll join us in celebrating pastors in the month of October. Great. Well, let's try to move into verse 2 here. We're moving at a snail's pace.
Welcome to my classes.
Yeah, that's right. It's mine too, man. I'm always a week behind. It says in verse 2, he was transfigured before them and his face shone like the sun and his clothes became white as light. And so unpack that verse for us. I actually have a couple of pastoral interns in our church who took hermeneutics with you, and they mentioned you using this text, I think, at some point, and they said you made a big deal about the clothes being white.
I wonder what I said about that.
I don't know.
Maybe I'll say it now. I don't remember.
It stuck with them, though, that this is what's happening when Jesus is being transfigured.
Yeah.
Unpack verse 2 for us.
Yeah. So when it says he was transfigured, that's just a term, metamorphosis. That's the Greek term that we get for like the scientific term of a caterpillar turning into a butterfly. But it was a religious term. It was often used actually in that time for God's kind of taking on human forms. They would transfigure. So it's a change in your physical appearance. That term is important because it's only used 4 times in the whole New Testament. Once here in Matthew, once in Mark. Luke actually doesn't use the term. He just says his appearance was changed. Mm. And then it's used twice for our own transformation.
Okay.
Yeah. 2 Corinthians 3, Romans 12, 1 and 2, be transformed is usually how it's used when it applies to us. Yeah. But sometimes I like to just translate, be transfigured by the renewing of your minds, because that's kind of what's going on. Transformed is a little more intellectual. I think that's how we typically think of it. But transfigured is used in terms of Jesus' own physical being. So it says he was transfigured before them. In Luke, we probably will never get to Luke, so I'll just add the little details here. In Luke, it says they went up to the mountain to pray, and Jesus is praying, they fell asleep. And so I think this happens at night because it says they're in a deep sleep. So typically when you see images of the transfiguration, it's like daylight and, you know, it's a brighter light and the sun is maybe shining behind Jesus and giving him some extra light. I actually think it's important to realize this light is coming from him, right? I think Luke implies it's nighttime.
It's not natural light.
Yeah, this is not natural light. This is something else. So he was transfigured before them. And I think immediately we should ask, well, what does that mean? And Matthew tells us some of the details. And each gospel writer says it slightly differently. It's only Matthew who says here, and his face shone like the sun. And then it says, and his clothes became white as light. All the gospel writers talk about his clothes. Mark is really cool because he's like, they became whiter than any oxyclean could make them. He actually has the Greek translation for oxyclean. It's amazing. But the point is, like, you can't go somewhere and make his clothes as white as they are. His face shining like the sun. I mean, you think of Revelation, obviously, when
22,
John sees him and his face shines like the sun.
John 1,
and then, Revelation 22, when there will be no need for the sun in the new creation because he will be our light.
Right.
So the biblical writers are picking all this up. But again, we want to think back to Moses too. Moses went up a mountain. He came down the mountain and his face was shiny. He had to actually put a veil over his face. But, and this is, I actually don't even remember what I said about the clothes. I feel bad in terms of what I said in the class. But
no, it was great. So
if you're
listening, come study at Midwestern, okay? Come
sit
in Dr. Shiner's class, you'll benefit.
I'm like racking my brain. I'm like, what did I say about the clothes? I can't even remember right now. So let me talk more about the face. What's important here though is, I think in my book, one of the things that I'd seen before is certainly Jesus is a new Moses figure. Like he's going up the mountain with a limited group of people and like there's a revelation there. But there's actually a huge difference between Jesus and Moses here because Moses goes up the mountain to see God. It's Jesus who is God.
Yeah.
And so Moses's face is reflecting the glory of God. Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God.
That's
so
good.
Moses's light from his face is derivative, to use a bigger word.
Yeah.
Jesus's is essential. And so it's actually probably better to think of, in one sense, it's Peter, James, and John, who are more like Moses, going up to have the Christophany, theophany, whatever language you want to put on it. And they're the ones who see Yahweh in the face of Jesus Christ. I do think this is fulfilling all of those Old Testament texts. And I mean, we could talk about, as we even talk about the next verse with Moses and Elijah, but you want to think about Moses, the narrative of Moses' life, the church fathers talked about Moses' life as he saw the Lord in the burning bush. Mm. He saw the Lord on Mount Sinai. And then in Exodus 33, he says to the Lord, show me your glory. In other words, Moses is like, I haven't seen enough. I need more, yep. Which is a great desire, right? Mm-hmm. And God says to him, hey, I will show you, but you can't see my face, right? I'm going to hide you in the cleft of the rock. If you remember that narrative, yep. Right? I'm going to hide you in that cleft of the rock. And you can't see my face because if anyone sees my face, they will die, right? You can't behold me in my essence, really, right? Yep. But here, you kind of, this is the fulfillment, and we're about to see Moses is actually here on the mountain with them, right?
Yep.
This is the fulfillment of Moses longed to see the glory of the Lord. I think this is picking up all these Old Testament texts and saying, this is the face of the Lord in the face of Jesus Christ, who is one with Yahweh, who is the Son of God. And this is the fulfillment of Sinai, of actually seeing who God is in Jesus Christ. And so his face, that's huge. I mean, I even did a search. I didn't even think about this before I started studying this more. It rarely speaks about Jesus' face in the Gospels, almost never. I think the only other time, I could be getting this wrong, but he turns his face towards Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and then Gethsemane, it talks about his face as well, the sorrowful of the face. Yep. I think those are the only three times here, turning his face towards Jerusalem, and there, that it speaks about his face. And so just the nature of referencing his face here, I think, is huge. And for Matthew, that is picking up that mosaic themes, but it's doing so much more than that. So you want to ask any other questions about that? Again, I can't remember what I said about the clothes. But.
Yeah. No, that's great. I think the Exodus 34 passage, I love that passage in general.
Yeah.
Which is a side comment here pastorally. When people think about God in the Old Testament, you know, sometimes there's this idea, you know, they think about the Canaanite genocide and judgment. And yet when God reveals himself to Moses, he graciously reveals himself to Moses. Of course, you can't see his face, but, you know, the train of his glory passes by. And then what does God say about himself? The Lord, gracious and merciful.
That's right.
Slow to anger.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's not the conception people have of God in the Old Testament. And yet in the Old Testament, God is gracious and merciful.
And he reveals himself in his name.
Yes.
Yeah, in Exodus 33. Maybe I remembered part of what I said about the clothes.
Yep.
Certainly there's this tradition in Jewish tradition of, you know, Adam and Eve, they're naked in the garden and then they try to clothe themselves and then God gives them clothes. And so there's probably something going on because in Jewish tradition, it's often describes Adam and Eve as kind of existing as these shining figures in the garden, which is interesting. Again, it's not in our scriptures. It is in the Jewish tradition. But I think that's kind of giving us a picture of how they viewed it. It does talk about the garden with all these bright gemstones, which matches kind of these pictures of the heavens that you can see all these gemstones. You hear about that in Isaiah 6 and Revelation and so forth and so on. Even the new temple or the new creation has all these gemstones around it.
You've mentioned several times in the following verse, you know, Moses and Elijah explicitly mention they're present here. And so what's the significance of these two figures? Often when the transfiguration is talked about, a lot of the discussion lands here on why Moses and why Elijah. People differ as to why they're present. So what's going on with these two guys?
Yeah, yeah. So 17:3 talks about Moses and Elijah suddenly appear with them. So again, you got to picture the scene. Disciples fall asleep, too long of a prayer meeting. They can't handle it, right? And they're in deep sleep. And suddenly they wake up. It's this bright, shining, like, moment. And then they see Moses and Elijah. So Moses has been dead like 1,400 years. Elijah, 900 years. A lot of the church fathers are like, how did they recognize them? And I'm like, that's a great question. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
But they recognize probably spiritually. They just understand this is Moses and Elijah. And, you know, I think there's a bunch of reasons why they're there. I think the main reason from maybe a more covenantal like storyline of scripture is that they represent the law and the prophets. And so here's these two figures. The big question Jesus is like, is he the messianic son? Is he the one that they've been hoping for? And Moses and Elijah appear next to him, talking to him, saying, yes, he's fulfilling this tradition of the Old Testament. But I would say, you know, I spoke about this, Moses and Elijah with a Moses, he longed to see God. But Elijah, many scholars think it's in 1 Kings, I'm forgetting the reference right now, but in 1 Kings, it's Elijah who also goes up to a mountain. And most scholars think it's the same mountain that Mount Moses was on. And he hears, remember, God is not in the fire, but he hears him in the soft whisper.
Yeah, still small boy. Yep.
And so, you have these two narratives where I think these two figures uniquely long to see God, and it was actually Elijah who was brought up to the heavens, right? He didn't die. He was brought up to the heavens. And so I think there's kind of a dual reality going on here in terms of Moses and Elijah representing the law and the prophets, but also they were the ones who requested to see God uniquely. And so now it's fulfilled. So there's all this neat stuff going on with Moses finally sees Yahweh in the face of Jesus Christ. So does Elijah. Moses, for the first time, is in the promised land. Remember, he wasn't able to go to the promised land with Jesus. He's now in Emmanuel's land with Emmanuel himself. Yeah, then you also have all this other stuff with, like, you have kind of heavenly witnesses and earthly witnesses to this event. You might have some symbolism going on with Elijah is pulled down from the heavens and Moses is pulled up from the earth because Elijah went straight to the heavens. Moses was buried in the earth. Again, you got to think about your eschatology with that, if that works. So there's just so much going on. In Luke, it says they're actually appear with him in glory. I think it's a picture of Jesus's glory is going to be shared with those who follow him. So it's hope by revelation. Remember how we started.
Yeah.
This is Jesus. He's going to die, but they're going to die as well, but they're going to share in his glory. First John, like, when we see him, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. It's by beholding him that we become like him.
Yeah, that's great. And I didn't look it up here. I know, like, 1 Kings 17 is, I think, Elijah on Carmel, and it's right after that, 18, 19, somewhere in there, the passage you mentioned. And it does remind me, as you're talking, I'm listening and, you know, kind of putting, you put pieces together, but you have Jesus in Luke 24 when he's on the road to Emmaus and he tells those two discouraged disciples, you know, foolish and slow of heart to believe all that was written in me and the law of Moses and the prophets. Mm-hmm. Didn't you know that the Messiah must first suffer and then enter his glory?
That's right.
And here they're seeing,
totally,
you know, with the context you set up earlier, 16 and 17, suffering, then glory. So, man, this is all so helpful to put, you're starting to put together teaching and pieces of the gospels that you may not have.
The one imperative we haven't got to yet, but it says, listen to him. But Moses and Elijah are there who've predicted the sufferings of Christ, right?
Yeah.
So what do they need to listen? This is actually one of the only narratives where Jesus doesn't speak. It just kind of something happens to him. And it's weird that the command, because he doesn't speak, is listen to him. But you go back to the context, what has he just talked about? His death and then his resurrection. Listen to him. And Moses and Elijah are standing there next to him. And they're like, listen to him. We predicted this beforehand. In Luke, it tells you what they're talking about. It's about his departure, which is the word Exodus. So, you know, Moses is like, hey, I took them through Exodus. And Jesus is explaining, no, that pointed to a greater Exodus, which is to come. So it's neat that you have Luke kind of giving you the minutes of the meeting, right? Yeah, while the other gospels are just like, no, we're not going to tell you what they're talking about.
That's awesome. Well, I want to give you a chance here, and we're getting close to time, but I want to give you a chance to talk about the voice appearing and God speaking. But before that happens, you know, Peter and, you know, again, there's always ideas or opinions as to what Peter's doing here. But it's unsurprising, given Peter and the other gospels, that he's the one who speaks out. He spoke out right before this. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. But here he says, Lord, it is good that we are here. If you wish, I will make three tents here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. So what's the significance of that? Often you hear guys say, well, hey, he's putting, you know, Moses and Elijah on the same level as Jesus. Is that what Peter's doing? If a guy's preaching through this, how do they explain what's happening?
Yeah, in Mark it says he didn't know what to say, for they were terrified. So I think we're going to interpret this as, like, this is kind of a gaffe, right? This is, I call it a blunder. So before, and it's important in verse 5, it says, while he was still speaking, the voice kind of interrupts and corrects him. And so you have to take Peter's statement in conjunction with the cloud, the Father speaking from the cloud. So in short, I mean, he does say it's good that we are here. I think there's allusions to Genesis there. Again, like the very good creation. It is good that they're here. Yep. Jesus called them up there. And there's a lot of debate about the three tents, but here's where I kind of landed on this. I think you want to think about the three and the tents or the shelters, right? So the three, I do think he's putting Moses, Jesus, and Elijah in some sense, I'm going to make three tents here for you. And the response is, this is my beloved son. They are prophets. This is my son. You think about Hebrews, right?
Yeah.
Hebrews 3 and 4. he was a servant, but Jesus is the Son. Yeah. And so I think Peter is still kind of misunderstanding, like, you're the Messiah, you're the anointed, but they were kind of anointed type figures as well. Okay. So he's still coming to a greater understanding. This is my beloved Son. And so that's the three, but the tents, there's a lot of debate. Like, is this Feast of Tabernacles allusions? Is this the Tent of Meeting allusions? I think the numbers don't really work out for those interpretations. There might be some allusions there, but I think you just go to the most simple explanation of what are tents. Tents are to dwell in, to stay in a place. And I think Peter is like, hey, here's glory. Let's keep this going. Yeah. Like, let's prolong this scene. So I think he misunderstands the singularity of Jesus Christ. And then he misunderstands the kind of timing, the suffering aspect, which Jesus has just talked about. Yeah. So Peter's like, hey, we're here in glory. Like, let's go. It's kind of the Acts 1:6 moment again. And Jesus, the voice is like, no, this is my beloved Son, and we're about to get here. I think that alludes even to the Genesis 22. He's got to die. Yeah. And Isaac was almost a picture of that. And so Peter, I do think this is a blunder. He's misunderstanding, and he's going to be corrected.
Yeah. Genesis. I'm actually preaching Genesis 22. We're preaching through Genesis now. Yeah. I'm preaching it on Palm Sunday. I'm chewing on it already.
Oh, here we go.
But like, this is my Son. That, you know, take your Son, your only Son, the Son that you love, the threefold repetition.
Only Son, it's all over
and
there.
This connection. I'll probably be making this connection in that sermon.
That's great. That's great.
Thanks for the heads up. So after Peter says this, you know, and again, one of the practical takeaways, if you're listening, is if you don't know what to say, don't say anything. Peter doesn't know what to say, so then he starts talking. That's a bad strategy.
It's a good advice for students in our classes, too.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Apologies if you're listening, students. It's a good lesson for us. He speaks, and then God does interrupt. God speaks. And so you have here, you know, in verse 5, while he's still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. A voice from the cloud says, so you have cloud, you have the voice of God, the Father. This is my beloved Son with whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him. And so, yeah, unpack that for us.
Yeah. So first, it's important that he speaks out of the bright cloud. This is like Exodus again. God often would speak out of that pillar of cloud. Also, this is the Shekinah cloud that falls on the temple. So the only reason they're able to be in the cloud, which I actually make the argument in the book, the cloud is representative of the Holy Spirit. That's how the cloud is represented in the Old Testament. So I think you actually have a Trinitarian picture here. You have the Son, you have the Father, and then you have the Spirit in the cloud, which matches the baptism. It's just the Spirit appears as a dove there. Yeah. This is the exact same phrase as in the baptism. So he speaks from the cloud, from the Spirit in one sense, and says, this is my beloved Son. Again, this exact same phrase as the baptism. Again, as I said, it's in response to Peter's kind of blunder. This alludes back to Genesis 22, the sacrifice of Isaac. It also comes, this is my beloved Son, I think Daniel 7 and Psalm 2. So this is my beloved Son. Now, if you go back to Psalm 2, I think that's speaking towards his anointed task, but I think it's even speaking about, this is my only begotten Son. This is that he's different than Moses and Elijah. And because of that, I'm well pleased with him. Isaiah 42:1, right? Therefore, listen to him. How do you listen to him? Well, you listen to him in terms of his predictions of his death and his resurrection. You listen to him in terms of he fulfills the law and the prophets. And then here was the cool one that I had never seen before. There's a really important text in the Old Testament that says for Israel to listen. It's the Shema.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Listen, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. So interestingly, you have this command to listen, and it's Jesus who's shining with essential glory, who is the face of Yahweh. You listen to him because he is my representative. He is my eternally begotten Son.
Yeah, that's good. Let's wrap up here at the end with kind of, I'm going to call this the aftermath. So I'm going to cover a couple verses here together. But it says, when the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. So there's how they respond. Then Jesus comes, he touches him and says, rise, have no fear. Verse 8, they lift up their eyes. They saw no one but Jesus only. So a lot of verses there, but let's kind of turn the corner here as we get ready to wrap up. What's going on in the aftermath? What's Jesus doing? Yeah. Why are the disciples afraid? What's Jesus doing?
If you think of the Old Testament, to be in the presence of the Lord is a wonderful thing, but it's also a terrifying thing. And they are in the presence of Yahweh himself in Jesus Christ. So they appropriately fall on their faces and are terrified. People don't live in the presence of the Lord without the mediating work of Jesus Christ. So I think the only reason they're in the glory cloud and not destroyed is because Jesus is there. So I think it's giving you the beatific vision, what we're going to see, God himself, is an amazing thing, but it's not something that you tread lightly with. But Jesus comes and he comforts them. He's like, I am the mediator. It's actually a really poignant moment. And again, this one's only in Matthew. He touches them and he says, rise and have no fear. And I think that's just pointing to, like, he is our mediator. He is the one that allows us to be through him in the presence of the Lord. And I love the last verse. They lift up their eyes. They saw no one but Jesus. Like, what are the Gospels about? What is Christianity about? It's not ultimately about Moses or Elijah. It's about Jesus. He is the ultimate revelation. And so as they look up, it's not just they're gone, but that command, listen to him. It's the singular reference. It's like, it's all about him. So this text is just driving us like Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. It's all about him. If you want to understand Christianity, if you want to understand the cross, the resurrection, look to him.
Yeah, that's good. Jesus only. I love it. Well, thank you again for joining us in the studio.
Happy to be here.
This has been another episode of Preaching and Preachers, a podcast devoted to those who preach and the task of preaching itself. Thank you for listening and hope you'll join us again soon.
Thank you for being with us today and for listening to Preaching and Preachers. For more information, go to my website, jasonkallen.com. That's jasonkallen.com.